Last Saturday, my wife Philomena, our son Andrew, and my sister Sue, who's here, were in the theater district of Manhattan. We were squeezed and jostled by the large crowds on the chilly late December Saturday afternoon. With the sun pretty low in the horizon, shining in our eyes at times as we walked up to Central Park and then back down again, just taking in the sights. In the crush, I remember passing two people asking for money. One was an older gentleman who sat on the cold sidewalk near the street, shouting like a carnival barker, "Spare change? Need a little help here." I also remember passing a middle-aged woman wearing quite a lot of clothing, leaning next to an icy stone bricks of a building with a small basket of change next to her. She didn't look at us or say a word as we passed. I couldn't even tell if she was awake or not. I could have stopped and said hello to either of these people and offered them some attention or some money. I didn't. Even though we walked past thousands of people on those streets, I've only remembered them and wondered about their situation. I wondered if I should have paused to offer them at least a little compassion. I think I was a little more sensitive to these two people because I was mulling over the topic for today's service, compassion. Religion usually lines up very strongly on the side of compassion as a religious obligation, especially for the poor. The great commandments to love God and neighbor are pillars of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. If I were taking counsel from Jesus, found in the Good Samaritan parable, I would have gathered them both up and taken them to an inn. Jesus spent a lot of time healing and comforting the outcasts. The Abrahamic faiths all emphasize the compassionate nature of God. Traditionally, Judaism enumerates God's 13 attributes of mercy. Some of these qualities identified in the book of Exodus are compassion before and after a person sins, graciousness when in distress, being slow to anger, and forgiving of iniquity, transgressions, and sins, and pardoning the guilty. Allah's most repeatedly praised quality in Islam is being merciful and compassionate. Every chapter of the Quran, except one, starts with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, most merciful and compassionate. Eastern religions are no less appreciative of compassion. The Buddha's attendant Ananda asked him, "Would it be true to say that the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion is part of our practice?" The Buddha replied, "No, it would not be true to say that the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion is part of our practice. It would be true to say that the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion is all of our practice." Because of the world religions value compassion so highly, Karen Armstrong used it as a unifier to bring people around the world together using her Charter for Compassion as that vehicle. I wrote about that in my Windows column for January if you want to read more about that. Compassion literally means joining with another person's suffering. There are moments when we are spontaneously moved to action when we encounter someone in pain. When Sigrun Newell fell right over here a couple of weeks ago. She was surrounded, and people rushed to her aid. When Jackie Williams fell just out here a month ago, she also had people come to her aid immediately. If we had a big crisis in our congregation and our members needed food or clothing, you know there would be an outpouring of support. I expect if our neighbors on West Street and Bradford Street were suddenly in trouble from some disaster, we'd be there to help them. This kind of immediate, heartfelt, emotional response seems both natural and good to us. But ancient Greeks and Roman philosophers would not have been so enthusiastic. They would have wanted us to be guided by our reason in our actions rather than by our feelings. When danger of our compassion being guided by our emotions is in the area of justice, symbolized by the blindfolded woman holding a scale. In a courtroom, the defendant should be convicted or go free based on the evidence, not on how we feel about the victim or the accused. The defendant may sway us emotionally toward mercy and compassion, yet be clearly guilty and deserving of punishment. On the other side, think of the racial bias that leads to the high level of incarceration of people of African descent. Would we want to condone a father or a mother taking revenge against someone who has harmed their son or daughter, even though emotionally we might wish to do so? These are good arguments to moderate our compassion with reason. I had the opportunity to explore this distinction when I served briefly as a chaplain in a Florida hospital as part of a 6-month pastoral care training. I found it easy to feel compassion for and offer comfort to the patients that I visited. Sometimes, though, my rational mind interfered. Visiting a severely obese person with congestive heart failure, a heavy smoker with lung cancer, and an alcoholic with cirrhosis of the liver could bring up resistance to feeling compassion. Of course, thin people have heart failure. Non-smokers get lung cancer, and non-drinkers have liver failure too. What I noticed during my hospital visits was my all too human tendency to judge interfered with my feelings, limiting my willingness to feel another person's suffering. A woman named Mary had a powerful lesson in what opens and closes the heart to compassion. Her teacher was her son, 7-year-old son, Sebastian. She writes, "It was a bitter winter in Wiesbaden, a beautiful but rather stuffy city in Germany. Sebastian and I were visiting my mother. On that particular day, just a week before Christmas, darkness had fallen early. I was hurrying through an underpass to catch the bus home. Suddenly, I felt Sebastian tug at my coat sleeve. I looked down. 'What's up?' 'Mom,' he said, 'why don't you give that lady any money?' I looked back and saw a woman sitting in a threadbare blanket begging. 'Oh,' I said, shaking my head, 'she would most likely use any money I gave her for drugs and alcohol.'" Let me pause here in telling this story to encourage us to turn inward and examine our own response to the situation, if we've been in this situation. How often have you maybe had those same thoughts? I confess that I had those thoughts in New York City last weekend. It's a common defense against giving money to people on the street. In my research this week, I read a challenge to this defense against compassion. from a white anti-racist activist, Tim Weiss. He makes a habit of always giving money and questions this assumption as a reason not to give. He points out that if an employer suspected that an employee would be getting drunk on the weekend, the employer wouldn't choose to withhold the employee's salary to prevent it. He writes, "To suggest that one is withholding money from homeless people or beggars for their own good is a dishonest and preposterous conceit. If you feel that the poor don't deserve your support because of their presumed moral failings, so be it. If they would just take out your garbage, they might be entitled to your dollar in alms and the hooch that said dollar might help them obtain. But if they merely beg for it without first performing some labor, then whether or not they have a drug or alcohol problem, you will be free to presume they have both and refuse to aid them." Mary's 7-year-old son didn't presume so. Her story continues, "Sebastian took my hand and looked up imploringly. Only someone who is very unhappy would sit in the cold and beg, don't you think?" I blushed. Then I walked back and gave her some money. Now, I don't want to make this easy. I wasn't there. I didn't see the woman. Maybe she's a con artist. Maybe she makes 400 euro a day sitting there looking miserable. I've heard stories about skilled people who do make a lot of money begging and borrowing. And if you don't believe that, I have a guy from Ethiopia I'd like you to meet who needs help with a $10 million inheritance. Well, I don't believe there are simple answers for when and how to be compassionate to another. I do believe wise guidelines for our compassionate response can help. They can help to unite our head and our heart when we are moved by another person's suffering. And there are a number of ways our compassion can go wrong and do more harm than good. Those harmful ways are sometimes called idiot's compassion. One kind of idiot compassion is rejecting the process of identification with the suffering of another person. In this case, the feeling of compassion arises, but makes us uncomfortable, and we want to make it go away. My first memory of this kind of feeling was during the Biafran Civil War. On the news, you'd see pictures of little dark-skinned children with swollen bellies and flies on their faces that were very disturbing to look at. I was more identified with a feeling of disgust looking at the picture than I was feeling connected to the suffering of the child. My giving of money was less for the food and more because I didn't want to see that picture again. That same discomfort gets stimulated this time of year when we get those mailings, maybe you've gotten them, or see the ads featuring children with cleft palates. Now, I don't know whether this organization providing help to fix their birth defects are good ones or not, but I know that they're using those images of those children is somewhat exploitative. In the industry, it's called charity pornography. Using images of suffering to stimulate donations. It does work to stimulate giving, but it often generates more revulsion than it does compassion. Another kind of idiot compassion is being moved by the suffering of another and being willing to help, yet offering what isn't needed or wanted. I remember this form from when I cooked breakfast for homeless men who are sheltered at the Oakland Unitarian Church in the 80s. thinking that they would want a filling and nourishing breakfast, I made them sausage and eggs. It wasn't before long before I got complaints that the food was too high in saturated fat and cholesterol, and that we didn't have any tofu for the vegetarians. This happens in food pantries too. People donate uncommon foods. One of the ones that I'd like to donate is sardines, because sardines are very high in essential fatty acids, which I think would be good for them, but that maybe the clients at the pantry wouldn't touch. People commonly donate items to get rid of them rather than learning what is needed for these clients. The last kind of idiot compassion I'd like to mention is an unawareness of skillful means of helping. In a sense, awareness itself is at the core of wise compassion. When we recognize the object of our compassion, the source of the feeling welling up within us, and use our reason to skillfully choose our response, we are much more likely to be effective in making a positive difference. This iterative process that incorporates learning from our mistakes. And I am very aware of making mistakes. Just in the last couple of days, it seems like I have made a couple of those mistakes where I have had the opportunity to be compassionate and have missed them. And every time that happens, I remember my commitment, which is to witness the results of my actions or inactions and to learn from my successes and failures. In the process, I hope to grow a little wiser and increase my motivation to continually deepen that commitment to being loving and compassionate in word and deed. There isn't any perfection to be had in wise compassion, but we can become more skillful and more effective. The Buddha's first noble truth, the troubling presence of a stressful and unsatisfactory component of existence he called dukkha, has always captivated me. Being born sets us up. Being born sets us up for having sickness. If we're fortunate, growing old, and certainly dying. Sickness, old age, and death are not desirable, pleasant, or enjoyable. Jesus had his way of saying it. The poor will always be with you. We can have moments of freedom from difficulty, but there are burdens of being alive that we all must discover how to live with. And that shared dilemma of dukkha is itself the deep root that unites us all and serves as a common concern that fuels our compassion. The more we can recognize that common condition and identify and feel our shared reaction to it, the deeper will be our capacity for wise compassion. Ultimately, we don't have control of the outcome of our compassionate acts. We do have some control, however, over refining the intention that motivates them. By being wisely compassionate, we can strengthen the social fabric of our worldwide community and connect across boundaries of gender, race, culture, class, and ability. May wise compassion be a vehicle for the holy in me to meet the holy in you. And in that meeting, may our inherent worth and dignity find affirmation in our unity, embodying the spirit of life that brings us into being. So be it.